Thank you, Joe. Hi, everybody. My name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
And I'm real grateful to be here, and I want to just kind of say, starting out, that all I know to do on my own is what I've done before, you know, about talking about my experience with steps. So that's all I know to do. If any of you guys, this is, you know, all of our retreats, this is not my deal. And if you guys have a question or have something you want to say or want to take it some other way, let's do that. I mean, I really don't want this to be real formal in any way. When I do this, where I just talk, basically, it's usually a bigger group than we've got here. If it's all right with everybody else, we'll just sort of see, sort of let it find its own level here and see what happens. I'd like to start out with a little prayer that is used before some step study things, if we could, just kind of help God get me going in the right direction. God, please let me set aside everything I think I know about myself, about my alcoholism, about these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my alcoholism, these steps, and especially you. Amen. How many of you guys have heard my story? I thought over half of us have, so I... What's that, Joe? I got a little water. I'm fine. Thank you, buddy. I think in time we're talking to one another that it's real helpful for us to know a little bit about where the person's coming from. So I want to take just a very few minutes and tell you a little bit in a general way what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. I grew up on a farm down in southwestern Kentucky. And as far back as I can remember, I was driven by an obsession with myself. And the big book tells me that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And the way my first sponsor, and we'll probably hear an awful lot this weekend about Cherry Carpenter. Wasn't Jerry, it was Cherry, Cherry. And Cherry used to, in his talk, he would say that his wife, Bobby, was the only woman he knew who'd been married 40-some-odd years and still had her Cherry. that would cause people to remember Cherry's name. But Cherry said that while alcoholism is a whole lot of things, it's a physical allergy to alcohol coupled with mental obsession. It's an incurable, progressive, and fatal malady. It makes you sick mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. So while alcoholism is all those things, that it didn't start out as any of them. He said the very first thing wrong with us is that we've got a disorder of our ego. And I believe that with all my heart. And it took me years for the simplicity of the book. I thought Cherry had made that up or figured it out or something. And yet every morning of my life, as part of my morning meditation, I was reading that line in the book that says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And I just never was able to put it together that those are the same thing. If selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of my troubles, then the first thing wrong with me is I've got a disordered ego. And that obsession with myself goes back as far as I can remember. Didn't know there was any other way to be. You know, didn't go around thinking I'm obsessed with myself, because it literally never occurred to me that it was possible for there to be anything in this universe more important to me than how I felt. All of my life, the most important thing in the universe to me was how I felt. When I look back on it, And when I say look back, I'm not just talking about when I was drinking. I'm talking about my sobriety, too. Every time I have ever gotten in trouble, it has been immediately preceded by the demand that I feel better now, that I want to feel better now. And all my life, that the way I felt was just the center of everything. And that obsession with myself made it impossible for me to be comfortable inside. And I have always been an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, always capable of feeling too good for something and not nearly good enough for the same thing at the same time. And all these things still exist in some extent in me. And I didn't know that there was any other way to be than that either. Didn't occur to me there was anything wrong with it. But I spent my whole life, you know, junior high school, I'd think about asking a little old girl to go with me somewhere or like me, and one part of me would be saying, wait a minute, she's not good enough, she's not pretty enough, she's not on your social level, you don't need to be asking her out. Another part at the same time was saying, boy, if you ask that girl out, she'll laugh in your face for you being stupid enough to think that she might have anything to do with you. And both those things going on just as loud and clear, egomania, inferiority complex, wham, 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 wham. Didn't know I was driven by ego because I had this idea that ego was this old deal of thinking I was better than everybody. You know, thinking I was something on the stick and hot stuff. And I had some of that, but that was a fairly small percentage of the time. Most of the time, I didn't feel like I was coming out too well in my comparison with you. But the key is that the way I felt and the way I thought I compared to you every day, every hour, every minute was the most important thing in the world to me. And I realize now that it didn't make a bit of difference how I thought I came out in the comparison, or whether I felt good or whether I felt bad. As long as that's the most important thing in the world to me, I am absolutely and totally obsessed with self and run by ego. So I don't have to feel like I'm doing well at all to be overwhelmed with ego. In fact, most of the time, I have not felt very good at all when I'm overwhelmed with ego. Got drunk the first time when I was 12 or 13, and I was just flat off and running. Some magic happened. I did get in a lot of trouble, puke, blackout, and pass out the very first time I got drunk, but some magic happened before then. See, that pain and emptiness that obsession with myself had caused all my life, I'd never been free of that a minute that I know of. And I got free of that for a little while when I got enough of that booze in me. For the first time in my life, I felt like I was in the right place at the right time with the right stuff. For the first time in my life, I was able to be comfortable inside myself without running. And I believe that that's right at the heart of my powerlessness over alcohol. Now, I didn't have those conscious thoughts. You know, I didn't wake up the next morning with that terrible hangover and think, you know, I found something that I can never let go. I woke up and thought, my God, this is awful. Those Baptists are right. I'll never do it again. But within a week, I was drunk the second time because that other had happened. For the first time in my life, I'd gotten comfortable enough inside myself that I could stand the way I felt without running. And I believe at the heart of my powerlessness is simply that it didn't matter what it cost, because nothing else in this universe had ever done that trick for me. School was easy for me. That was one way that I kind of held up the mirrors to try to keep you from seeing what was really going on inside me, so maybe I wouldn't have to look at it. But for 25 years, from that first drunk until I got sober, and my dry date is April the 9th of 1981, and I was 37 when I got sober. I'm 53 now. And for that 25 years, between the time I first got drunk and the time I got sober, not only alcoholism, but alcohol stayed at the center of my life. I'm real confident that I went to bed drunk more than 80% of the nights in that 25 years. There was nothing in my life that happened that alcohol wasn't at the center of it. I didn't really have people in my life. I had positions in my life. And whatever your position was in my life, I usually had somebody else interviewed for it at all times. And I didn't want to be that way. I think that's probably a pretty good working definition of a sociopath. But by the time I was 15 years old, I had figured out that if you stayed around me long enough and close enough to me, and I don't care what your relationship was, whether you were my mama, my daddy, my girlfriend, my best friend, I worked with you, whatever, if you stayed close enough to me long enough, that day was going to come when you were going to come to me and say something like, "You know, Don, I really like being around you. And being around you is exciting. And Don, you're a neat guy. But Don, there's something wrong with the way you drink. And there's something wrong with the way you live. And we need to look at that. We need to talk about that." And when you did that, you punched your ticket out of my life. Of course, now I didn't say, "You have just punched your ticket out of my life." And I didn't even have that thought. What I said was, "I'm so glad you brought that up. We do need to talk about that." Yeah. But the truth was that if you didn't change your position, you kept on questioning this only thing in the universe that ever made me feel comfortable enough inside that I could stand the way I felt without running, it didn't matter. Because you were going to have to get out of my life. You know, I might spend a year or two trying to bribe you and sweet-talk you and threaten you and browbeat you and everything else. But in the final analysis, if you kept on calling time on me, I couldn't afford you, and I had to get you out of my life. And that's why I always had somebody interviewed for every position in my life. I had some material success. I drank and worked. I left the farm when I was 16, and that was purely because of my drinking. Purely because of the mess that I was in on account of my drinking. I was an early admission student at the University of Louisville at 16. Now, over the next 8 years, I drank and worked my way. I only went to 1 year day school and went the rest of undergraduate and law school at night, and drank and worked my way through undergraduate and law school, and that's just a blur. I have not a handful of memories of that whole 8 years. It was just a blur. In the spring of 1968, I graduated from law school, and my daughter, who was my only child for over 20 years, was born. And I started practicing law in downtown Louisville, and I practiced from 68 to 78 for 10 years with pretty good little bit of material success. I sometimes say when I'm at a podium and just telling my story, because it's true, and people used to get a kick out of it, is that the first few years I was giving AA talks, I genuinely had been fabulously successful during those 10 years. And if I stay sober and live another 15 or 20 years, I may have been a total failure during those 10 years. But the best I can do right now is I was moderately successful. And that happens, as things get in a different focus as we stay sober longer, because I couldn't have been more honest when I was standing up there telling people how fabulously successful I had been. I see now that that wasn't exactly the case. I don't know how I'll see it 10 or 15 years from now. But during that 10 years, I did function at my work. I made some money, won some cases, got some publicity. But during that 10 years when I could still hold on to the material things by my fingernails, I couldn't put gas in cars. I'd run out of gas two or three times a month in Louisville in a brand new expensive automobile with a pocket full of money and a pocket full of credit cards. In 1976, I've never been able to remember whether it was three or four new Corvettes in that same year, and not a single one of them was ever washed once. I was too sick to take a car to a car wash. I just couldn't do it. It just gets so dirty, I'd just get so disgusted, I'd have to get rid of it. I couldn't take my clothes to the cleaners. I couldn't take care of my teeth. I couldn't have anything that resembled any kind of real relationship with any other human being on any level whatsoever. And yet I was like an idiot savant. You know, I could hang on to that law practice and make a little money and stick that in your face when you said there was, you know, indicated there was something wrong with me, and keep on going. Started using a lot of things other than alcohol during that 10 years. Don't think they were important to my story at all during that period, because my alcohol use was so overwhelming. Everything else that I did was to complement the alcohol, either to make the effect of the alcohol more dramatic or to try to help me function with the hangovers, which I had to do. The phenomenon of craving that the book talks about, which is a simple thing, all that is the physical addiction to alcohol. And once the phenomenon of craving sets in, then once we get some alcohol in our bodies, not only our mind and our soul, but our body craves another drink. And I had that phenomenon the first drink I ever took. But for many, many years, the fear... See, nobody ever had to tell me that drinking the next morning would cure a hangover. I'm absolutely convinced that I was born knowing that in the marrow of my bones somewhere. But for all those years, the fear that if I drank around the clock the way I'd always needed to, that you would see what I was and I'd have to look at what I was just a little bit stronger than the physical need. Of course, eventually that physical need progressed and got a little bit stronger than the fear that you would see and I'd have to look. But at any rate, February 1978, I was full of booze and dope and drove a car off the road at about 130, tore my body all to pieces, was in the hospital 6 months out of the next year, had a half dozen major surgeries, lost my urinary function for over a year, lost the main artery in one lower leg. Doctors told me I'd probably never walk again without at least braces on both legs and one or two canes, and if they doubted we could find a surgeon that would ever be able to do anything about my urinary function. Turned out, by the grace of God, I've been sober 16 and a half years and haven't owned a brace or a cane for probably 17 and a half years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University got my plumbing put back together so that my urinary function was restored. But while I was laying in the hospital bed flat on my back, it was 2.5 months before they stood me upright on a tilt table for the first time. And my reaction to that was to have my friends bring me in booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me. And I would lay there in that bed with the drink in my hand and say really intelligent things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough if they don't have any backbone. And then I'd explain to them that it took a man to lay in there with it when the bills started coming in, and that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he wasn't prepared to do the time. And I'd tell them when I'd been out there playing, I knew the piper had to be paid and they wasn't going to hear me whining. Fix me another drink. And I was going to go on with it as best I can. And that's real insanity. It's real powerlessness. I was right where I was after that first drunk. Didn't matter. Didn't matter what it cost. I didn't have anywhere else to go as far as I knew. I didn't know there was anything in this universe that could do that deal for me inside, make me feel that good enough in there that I could stand it. So it didn't matter. I proceeded over the... About a year after that wreck, I didn't go broke right away because a little law firm had built up around this other guy and myself. Money kept on coming in for a while. But about a year after the wreck, I made it to the asylum the first time for drinking and drugging. That was sometime around the first year of 79. I remember they got me. By that time, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to sit up in a chair after they started to separate me from alcohol. They set me up in a chair and had an AA meeting. Somebody read how it works, got to step 3. We had made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him, and that offended my intellect. So I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean tell me that the people in this world who believe such crap?" And I went and called somebody to get me away from those religious fanatics before they somehow polluted my pristine intellect. And that was, as I say, sometime around the first year of 79. I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81. During that 2.5 years, I don't remember much. I think I remember even less than I do about the 8 years of drinking my way through, then working my way through school. But some of the things I know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I lost my law license. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I wound up with a new wife who had to leave me, and she died during that period. I last laid eyes on my daughter, my only child, in January of 1980. Turned out I wasn't going to see her again for over 3 years in February of 1983. I lived without an address on the street for about a year and a half. And I lived for every day of that year and a half with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. Because, see, folks were telling me a good half of those 18 asylums I was in had treatment programs that were based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have any place to go, usually, sometimes I would go to a lot of meetings between trips to the asylum. So I had a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous. As far as knowledge about it, I had a head full of it. And what would happen is that one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my illness, see, this malady called alcoholism is a peculiar sucker. One aspect of it is that it talks to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't think my alcoholism ever tried to kill me, because I don't think it cares whether I live or die. I think that's totally irrelevant to my alcoholism. I don't think it's got but one purpose in this universe, and that's to somehow increase the chances of getting that next drink. And it'll tell me anything in this world to get that drink. It'll tell me something that'll kill me. It'll tell me something that'll kill you. It just doesn't care. It'll tell me inconsistent things back to back, wham, wham, wham. Now, the trouble is that there's another part of my illness, which is an illness of perception. Now, what that means is I don't see things right. I don't hear them right, and I don't understand them right. And what that means is that I've got another part of my brain that, while this part is lying to me and doesn't care if it kills me, I've got another part over here that will believe it. Mm-hmm. And see, what would happen during that year and a half is that one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life, and my brain would go, well, yeah, I know it works for you guys. Of course, compared to me, y'all are simple minded, and it can't work for anyone of my intellectual standing, and you folks just don't understand. Lord, I've played on such a broad stage in life, and my life has just been so complex, and Lord, my tentacles have touched so many, and you don't understand that I see things more clearly than ordinary people, my Lord, and I feel them so much more deeply and acutely. My God, I'm wounded by my own understanding. You know, my soul is just too big for my body. So it won't work for me. And by that time, I'd usually have tears in my eyes that it was so nice that you folks could accept this little myth of a higher power and it'd work for you. But, of course, it couldn't work for anybody of my magnificence. The very next heartbeat, I mean, without missing a beat, one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain would go, yeah, I know it works for you guys. But you guys don't know about the parts of me that have just flat always been missing, that just aren't there. You guys don't know that I've never really been able to be responsible about one single thing consistently in my whole life. And you don't know that I've never really been able to love anything or anybody in my life, not even myself. And you don't know that anything in my life that looks like it was any kind of good or even okay is some kind of fraud and a pack of lies and a house of cards. And you don't understand that it might work for you, but y'all don't know that I've destroyed everything and everybody on my path, and then I've salted the earth and burned it over. There's nothing for me to get sober with. There's nothing for me to get sober on. And there's nothing for me to get sober for. And then my illness would also be telling me back on that greatness. One of the big things that it told me is that certainly I knew I was an alcoholic, and I did. I intellectually had accepted that I was an alcoholic by the time I was 15 years old, and I never took that decision back. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. That has nothing on earth to do with First Step Alcoholics Anonymous. Not a thing in the world. because, see, I thought I could live with alcoholism. Mm-hmm. In fact, I thought it was kind of romantic and cute to have it. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was going to be kind of like having a bad leg or a bad arm. It was going to be inconvenient, and maybe I'd die 15 or 20 years earlier than I would have otherwise. But when you're that age, who in the world wants to live to be 30 or 40 years old, for God's sake, you know? Mm-hmm. So old you get no good to yourself or anybody else. And that mistake liked to have got me. But at any rate, what my illness would tell me was that my problem was bigger than alcoholism. I didn't have any problem that I had alcoholism, but see, y'all were just so simple-minded in your view of it, you didn't understand that, Lord, my problem was so much bigger than alcoholism that the alcohol thing was just a little result of this magnificent mess that was Don Major's life. And I couldn't take out the little consolidation loan like you guys could and claim it was all alcoholism and do those little 12 steps that I could have mastered in an hour and a half and get all right. Now, the kicker is that with my brain telling me back to back that it wouldn't work for me because I was so magnificent, and then coming right back that it wouldn't work for me because I was so totally worthless, I'd believe it both times. Believe it both times, and it wasn't even occurring to me that anything was wrong with that. But it'd be wham, wham, wham. But at any rate, I wound up, lost literally everything. Literally all of it. Law license got jerked. Lived on the street, as I said. Lived every day with the conviction that I had to die. Assumed I was under indictment, and I think that was good, sound assumption. I don't think there was any paranoia in it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I believe a loving God went back and poured oil on the troubled waters of my past to keep some of the worst of my fears from happening. I washed up on the doorstep of an asylum in Nashville, Tennessee in the fall of 1980, and that was asylum number 17. They let me in because they didn't think I'd live. They told me later that they didn't think I would live a week if they left me on the street. So I stayed in there, and I got out, and I had no place to go, and had no home, had no car, had a change and a half of clothes, teeth falling out of my head. And my roommate's family felt sorry for me, and they said, "Hey, Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days, and let's try to figure out what to do with you." And what to do with me was quite a question in the fall of 1980. And I went and lived with those good folks for 1 year on charity. They celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in July. They're living in Florida now, and I talked to them on their 50th anniversary. They're beautiful people. They weren't really real involved in AA. They were just decent, loving people, and their son had been in the asylum with me, had been my roommate. So for the first 6 months, I didn't stay straight there in Nashville, but I got better. I went to world meetings, most of them at the 202 Club, we called it, in Nashville. Got to where sometimes I could go 2 or 3 weeks without getting messed up on something, which was a world record for me. Even in the asylum, I had never been that long without getting messed up since I got drunk the first time. And they didn't put me back in the asylum but one time in that six-month period. And that was a lot of progress. At the rate I'd been going, I would have thought twice a year in the asylum was the picture of mental health. And late March of 81, I got on my most recent drunk, and April 8th, 81, I had been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks. I'd been drinking what had become my usual, and that was Listerine and pop-off vodka. And the truth is, man, and I've drunk a barrel of both those, and the truth is, I have fonder memories of the Listerine than I do of that old hot pop-off. You could get it 24 hours a day. You didn't have to die those thousand deaths at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, I wonder if you're going to have to throw a rock through a liquor store window, just go down the all-night market and get it, go around behind the store, and it was a miracle. You were well. And it'd get you just as drunk as the pop-off, and it. My really memory is that it tasted better. It wasn't either one of them real good, but my memory is Listerine was better than old hot pop-off. But on that last, most recent drunk, I'd been on both of them, and April the 8th, 81, 11, God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. And much to my surprise, the biggest of those gifts was that my loving God gave me the first little bit of teachability or humility that I'd ever had in my life. the first willingness to do some things that were suggested about my life, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, or I didn't think they would work. See, it had never occurred to me that I should or could voluntarily do anything about my life unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work. And you know, that still doesn't sound too bad, 16 and a half years sober. But you see, when I do that, I realize now that I put the ultimate veto power in the universe in my brain. Of course, it doesn't feel like the ultimate veto power in the universe. It feels like common sense. And that's the way my insane ideas still come up to me today. You know, if something walks up to me and says, "Good morning, Don, I'm a crazy idea and I'm here to kill you," there's a pretty good chance I won't mess with that thing. You know, there's a pretty good chance I'll step around it. So my insane ideas don't ever come up that way. My insane ideas come up grinning and say, "Good morning, Don. I'm common sense." Said, you know, anybody would do this if they were in your special position. You ever think about how special your position is, Don? Heavens, there's nobody in your particular position. And besides, most people are doing it anyway and just won't admit it. And you know, if you do it, Don, look at all these wonderful things that'll happen to you and people around you. This is not really selfish, Don. You're doing this as much for other folks as you are yourself. And look at what you might lose if you don't do that. Say, "Well, Lord, Don, you know you got to do that. This is common sense." And that's the way my insane ideas still come up to me. And that's the way my ultimate veto power in the universe was that I had in my brain. It felt like common sense. But what it was a death sentence for me. With what I've got wrong with me, with this incurable, progressive, and fatal thing that I've got wrong, as long as I was going to depend on my brain, that I wasn't voluntarily going to do anything unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work, I was absolutely under death sentence. And worse than that, I had the chief inmate in charge of the asylum, and I didn't know any of that. But by the grace of God, I was given that first little bit of teachability, and not thinking it would work for me. I went to an awful lot of meetings there in Nashville. First 60 days I was sober, went to over 150 meetings. Most of them didn't feel good. During most of them, I didn't believe they were working. Didn't believe alcoholism was my main problem. Didn't believe that the 12 steps would solve the problems that were in my life. But I kept on going to those dumb old meetings, and it turned out they worked just as well as if I'd been convinced it was that they were the very thing for me. See, I had that backwards. I had just about everything completely backwards. I thought in order for this deal to work, I had to believe it was working, and I had to feel like it was working. Turned out that didn't have a thing to do with anything. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, and let my old sick brain and soul finally get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind my raggedy butt. And they told me to get down on my knees every morning and every night. And I just, all tears came to my eyes, because I thought the second step was what was been killing me. And I tried to explain to them. I said, "Fellas, I can't do that. I've tried so hard." Because, see, I had that backwards, too. I thought that in order to recover, in order to get what you guys had, I had to somehow make myself start thinking, feeling, and believing the way it looked like to me you guys thought, felt, and believed. And I was absolutely convinced of that. So there was a 2.5-year period between that first trip to the asylum time I got sober. And during that whole period of time, I thought that was the key. If I was going to live, I had to somehow start thinking, feeling, and believing the way I thought you guys, or it looked like you guys thought, felt, and believed. And I started explaining that to them and telling them that there wasn't any way that I could do the praying, because I couldn't accept it, couldn't believe that way, and the second step was what was killing me. And I finally heard them when they said, "Don, we've never suggested that you think, feel, believe anything." And my mouth flew open, because I thought my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs were the center of the universe. They always had been. I mean, it just never occurred to me little Donnie could do anything he didn't want to do, didn't feel like doing. And if I didn't feel like doing something, what we needed to do was work on how little Donnie felt. And that's still my knee-jerk reaction. You know, if I don't want to go to work, You know what my first reaction is today? I want to call one of y'all and aggravate you about the fact that I don't want to go to work. And I want you all to help me want to go to work. What does whether I want to go to work have to do with anything, folks? I have to go to work. I simply have to go to work, and the only solution for me not wanting to go to work is for me to go to work. But my brain doesn't work that way. I want to work on the way little Donnie feels, because God knows we don't want him doing anything he doesn't feel like doing. You know, that'd just be the end of the world. But they said, no, said Don, in the first place, you're way too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs. Said, in the second place, your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs are your illness, and your illness is your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. And said, in the third place, the issue of whether you live or die is going to be determined solely by what you do. So what you think, feel, believe is not going to have anything to do with it at all. So they said, if you want to live, you get down on your knees and you start saying those words, and it doesn't make any difference what's going through your head. And I started getting on my knees, acting as if, my brain vetoing it and carrying on, telling me that it was crazy to be down there talking to the wall. But I started getting on those knees, and I started that in April 81, and to the best of my knowledge, I hadn't missed a morning or night since April of 81. And most of those mornings and nights, more than 50%, it ain't felt just exactly right. Many of those mornings and nights, I hadn't wanted to get down there. Some of those mornings and nights, I've been so scared or so resentful or so bitter that I couldn't remember the last word that I prayed. Many, many of those mornings and nights, it's felt like that the words were just bouncing back from the wall and that I was shut off absolutely from the sunlight of the Spirit and it wasn't getting anywhere. But you know what? Something's worked every day for 16 and a half years. So I've come to the conclusion that those guys were right, that it doesn't make much difference whether I feel like it's working or not, or whether I believe it's working. And I'm going to get down on those knees. I already did it before I got here. It's not very comfortable to get on your knees in that cabin in there, but I'm going to do that before I go to sleep tonight. I'm going to do that tomorrow. Eventually, my law license got put back in order as a byproduct of doing steps 8 and 9. I came back to Louisville, and lots of miracles have happened, and I'll talk about all those things during the steps. But I took me... from having been given a lot of gifts by God. My family was a good family, had about the average amount of problems. I don't know what a dysfunctional family is. The reason I don't is I've never met anybody who claimed that they came from a functional family. And until I can identify what a functional family is, I don't know how in the world I'm going to know what a dysfunctional family is. But I do know that I was the most dysfunctional thing in my family. And I don't believe my family caused my alcoholism at all, unless maybe somewhere through the genes, which they couldn't help any more than I could. But God gave me a lot of advantages in life and a lot of talents and good things. And I took those and I destroyed absolutely everything in my life. I was totally and completely at the bottom. God, when I was just became a little bit willing to start doing these things that I didn't understand, that I didn't agree with, and I didn't think would work, and began to start giving myself to this fellowship and to this program, God has made my life over the last 16 and a half years so much more beautiful than I ever dreamt life could be that there's no way I can tell you, fellas. I'll talk about that more when we talk about the 12th step probably Sunday morning, but I can't take credit, and believe me, I really don't take credit for anything that's happened in my life. I really don't. It's purely been by the grace of God. We'll talk in a lot of these steps. I have come to understand that this book refers to it in Bill's story. The 12 and 12 refers to it specifically in talking about step 6 and 7, but both books refer to the big, big book when they say that of myself I'm nothing, the Father does the work. Well, for some years sober, my brain edited that. I have to watch my brain. It likes to edit. And my brain edited that to really mean, of myself, I'm not enough, and I must have God's help. And I want to tell you, folks, for the last 7.5 years, it has meant just what it says to me. Of myself, I am nothing. And the Father does the work. And that'll lead us on in, talk a few minutes about an overview of this process that we're going to be talking about here. And fellas, I am not a teacher. There aren't any teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And over the years, I've seen some folks that seem like they maybe wanted to be teachers, and I haven't. They haven't seemed to have anything that I wanted. So even if they had teachers, I wouldn't be one. I'm just another drunk, and I'm here with you guys to do one thing, and this is so important to me. I hope I'm not going to try to tell you fellas anything that I know this weekend. Because, you see, what I know is still of real doubtful usefulness to me and sometimes gets terribly in my own way. So I don't see how in the world what I think I know is going to be helpful to you guys. But what I am, with God's help, going to try real hard to do, I'm going to share with you guys what I have done and what the results have been when I have done that. Because that's fact. One thing that made the whole thing of talking to people in AA a lot easier for me was that many years ago, it got real clear to me that God is not about to trust me with the welfare affair of a room or a boat full of people. You know, you guys are going to get what you need out of this weekend, whether it's with my help or despite me. I'm not that powerful. God's not going to turn this deal over to me. He's not about to, and that's just fine because that takes the pressure off for me. You're gonna get what you need, and I'm so imperfect. I mean, if I had to pick my main message to you, to anybody, it would be, folks, believe it when it says no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. And further, believe that it works just fine without being able to maintain perfect adherence as long as we are persistent. I found out that my God not only doesn't require perfection of me, God doesn't even require consistency. God seems to be real pleased with what happens to me, and there are times when I start the spiritual journey of this program over 100 times in a day. There still are. There are times when I'm overcome by self-will and I get off the beam and I get off on that self-centered rabbit track 100 times a day. And I found out that my God's forgiveness is limitless. And that's something that's grown in me in sobriety, because when I first got sober, I thought I had been so bad, and I was so amazed by the miracle that I was able to live and have any kind of life, that I really thought I had just about exhausted God's forgiveness. That God had just sort of grudgingly said, well, all right, asshole, I'm going to let you live. I'm going to let you live, but you take one bad step and I'll squish you like a bug. And that's an awfully uncomfortable way to live. And it turned out that I'm not big enough to exhaust my God's forgiveness. My God's forgiveness is totally inexhaustible, and that's a real good thing, because I need it every minute of every hour of every day. I need my God's forgiveness in the smallest things in my life, and I need my God's forgiveness in the biggest things in my life. And I need them right now. And for me, that's what this spiritual journey has been. It's been stumbling and falling and getting up and trying to remember where I was going from there. Got a buddy that says that the most important word in the 12 steps is continued. You know, that's the first word of the 10 steps, says continued to take personal inventory, and I believe that. That's the way it's been for me. I really hope that I don't say anything controversial this weekend. It is truly my prayer and my intention to conduct this weekend in the same tone that the big book is written. And if that book is written in one single tone, it is the tone of not being controversial. You notice there aren't absolute statements in this. And it was pointed out to me one time, I thought the guy was getting ready to give me a big compliment. It was Taper down in Arkansas. Good guy, I like him. And I'd given a talk, and he'd given a talk on Saturday night at a convention, and, you know, people are all pressing the flesh and telling you what a great spiritual giant you are and that sort of thing. You're listening to all that stuff and trying to discount it, and not many people will come up to you and say, you know, that's really the crappiest AA talk I ever heard. So you need to kind of take it with a grain of salt what folks tell you after you get done talking. But at any rate, I'm working my way through the crowd, and the Taper came up to me and said, I got to get me one of those Louisville big books. And I thought, well, I obviously have opened old Robert's eyes to something that he's been blind to before, and he's getting ready to give me a compliment here. He said, yeah, I got books that talks about alcoholism being a damn disease. He said, it don't say that anywhere in mine. And start talking about treatment modalities and that sort of thing. And it's not called a disease in there. And the reason it's not by accident, it's because that was a controversial issue. And the folks that wrote this book didn't want to involve themselves in controversy. So they called it an illness. They called it a malady. Mm-hmm. Got the same point across without stirring up the controversy. And that's truly what I want to do. And tell you real quickly about a gift that God has given me that I've had every day of my sobriety. And this is just as contrary to my nature as anything in the world. It's totally contrary to my nature. But God's given me the beautiful gift that it has never one single time occurred to me that I had any idea in the world what one of these steps or one of these traditions ought to mean to anybody else. And I have never been bothered by what it seems that any of these steps or any of these traditions mean to anybody else. So all I'm going to do is just talk about what I've done with it and what's happened. One thing that I will suggest, if I say anything this weekend that you believe conflicts with this big book, do yourself a favor. Go with the book instead of me. I'm going to try real hard not to say anything that conflicts with it. I'm a little bit like my sponsor, Cherry Carpenter. Cherry used to talk about all the, or he wouldn't talk about it, but when it was brought up, you know, all the literature that we've got that we can read about alcoholism, addiction, that sort of thing. Cherry was very nice about it. He said, well, I probably will get into all that, Don, as soon as I master the big book. Mm-hmm. Cherry never mastered the big book, apparently, because he never got into it. Other than the big book in 12 and 12, I have never read a book on alcoholism or addiction or psychology or any of that stuff. If I ever feel like I need to, I hope I will, and I'm not down in any of it. I believe in page 133 of the big book with all my heart. And 133 makes it totally clear that this world is full of good doctors and good counselors, and that we in AA shouldn't think that we have got a monopoly on anything, and that once we have applied the steps to our situation, if we've still got problems left, we don't hesitate to consult those doctors and those counselors. And I have folks I sponsor, and maybe folks I don't even sponsor, come up to me on a pretty regular basis. Say, I'm going to the doctor. The doctor says I need to take this kind of medicine. Should I take it? Partner, if you're going to a doctor and the doctor said take it, you're damn right you should take it. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a lawyer, not a doctor. You know, I'm not going to override a doctor's advice. I don't know about that. But 133 is pretty clear that we go to those folks for something other than our alcoholism. Because the situation seems to be, and really, practically every psychiatrist and psychologist that I know agrees with this. taken an alcoholic to a psychiatrist for their alcoholism is just like taking a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. It's not the surgeon's fault. There's just nothing in the jellyfish that the doctor can work on. And we seem to be exactly the way with the psychiatrist. I mean, so the psychiatrist's cure rate on alcoholism always was, still is, zero. And most psychiatrists will tell you that's not 1%, not 2%, not 5%, it's zero. So we need to make sure that we have used the steps. If we don't, and I'm afraid that a lot of us fall into this trap, I've probably fallen into it. If without fully using these steps, we get off into these rabbit tracks of the other thing, so many times it looks like to me we're standing on a whale's back fishing for menace. You know, we're standing on all the power in this universe, because what these steps are going to do, if we do them the way the book says, they're going to deflate our ego and they are going to join us with our loving Creator. And we're going to be plugged into all the power in the universe. And so if we ignore that, we wind up ignoring all the power in the universe and groveling for the little crumbs that we might be able to eke out of self-help and psychiatry and that sort of thing. And self-help, folks, Cherry Carpenter got the point across to me. This Alcoholics Anonymous is not in any shape, form, or fashion a self-help program. Alcoholics Anonymous is a God help program for helpless people. If we could have helped ourselves, we would have done it before we ever got here, because the most interesting subject on earth to every one of us was us. I mean, who tried harder to figure out what made them tick? Who was more obsessed with themselves than we were? You know, we already tried the self-help. It's not a self-help program. Ed and I were talking before we started. It's not a selfish program either. In fact, the book tells us that as ex-problem drinkers, our very lives depend upon the constant thought of others and how we can meet their needs. Now, how do you get a selfish program out of that? No, it's a selfish illness with a God-oriented and an other-oriented recovery. People get the impression that I'm saying stuff our feelings. I'm not saying stuff our feelings. These steps lead us into looking at our feelings, acknowledging them, and we've got our 10th step where, and our 11th and 12th step where we can continue to do that. But what I am saying is the way it has worked for me. Cherry told me that I have a crazy old picture show in the back of my head. You know, just all kinds of nutty things running, and it is. 16 and a half years sober, I've been banking with the same teller for 13 or 14 years. Have talked to her about her children growing up, going there two or three times a week. I still am apt to be standing there talking to Terry about her children and everything, look over there and see a stack of $100 bills and think about grabbing them and running. And I am crippled. I am crippled on top of that. Now, that doesn't bother me anymore. That doesn't bother me because that's just the old crazy picture show in the back of my head. And I can remember when I thought that the objective was to get rid of the picture show. And that as long as the picture show was still going on, that I was still sick. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way it is. Getting better is getting to the point where I don't have to obey the picture show. And where I understand that I can have feelings without building a shrine to them. And that the most important thing in the universe is not how I feel. Mm-hmm. That what goes in the record book is what I do. That is reality. And that doing the right thing, as long as I'm doing the right thing, my motive is kind of irrelevant, folks. Mm-hmm. My motive doesn't go into the record book. And I'm not sure that a person can do the right thing for the wrong reasons. Because that right action is real. That motivation, you know, all my life. When I was drunk, I was full of great intentions. Lord, I had the greatest intentions in the world. You know, just thought that was the thing. You know, the book says that the main purpose of this book is to allow us to find a power greater than ourselves to solve our problem. And I believe that with all my heart. What we're going to talk about this weekend isn't engineering our recovery, because it's been my experience that I can't do that. I don't even know what I'm supposed to be. Don't have any idea. If God gave me the power to become what I was supposed to be, I wouldn't have any idea what to become. So what I have to believe and what I do believe is that, yeah, I don't believe a farmer grows anything. I believe a farmer creates an environment in which growth can take place, and God grows things. And I don't believe a doctor heals anybody. I believe a doctor creates an environment in which healing can take place, and God heals people. So that's all we're going to try to do this weekend, is talk about how we can use these steps to create an environment in which healing and growth can take place, and let God step in and do for us what we can't do for ourselves. You know, on the old crazy picture show deal, and it not ever going away, but the reality being what I do, I was in an asylum one time. In fact, I think it was Mobile, Alabama. When you've been in 18 asylums in 2.5 years, they run together on you. But I think it's Mobile, Alabama. An old boy said, "You know, Don, they don't put you in the asylum for being crazy." And I know I was just kind of shocked. I said, "Well, they put me in here for being crazy." They said, "No, no." Said, "Don, they didn't put you in here for being crazy. They put you in here for acting crazy." And said, "I'll tell you something else. They don't let you out of the asylum for being sane. They let you out of the asylum for acting sane." And you know, I've been thinking, I've got to think about that over the years, and I could give affidavits on that, because I got out of asylums when I was crazy as a Bessie bug, by acting about half sane. And so when I get right down to it, that's the important thing. The insanity that'll kill me is not the insanity that I feel. It's the insanity that I do. As long as I don't act crazy, it's just real uncomfortable, but it's not going to really hurt a thing. We're going to talk about primarily the program this weekend. Now, the 12 steps I was taught and I believe are the whole program for recovery. In fact, the first 9 steps are the entire program for recovery. And I was taught and sponsored and believed, and this book tells me over and over and over again that once I've done those first 9 steps, the way this book says, I have recovered from alcoholism. Not recovering. And you don't have to get very far to see that the idea of a recovering alcoholic is a later, is something that came to us through the treatment centers. Because, how many of you, by the way, knew that the big book has got a subtitle? I didn't know it until really within the last year. I would talk about for all these years that the first paragraph to the foreword to the first edition makes 3 references to recovered alcoholics. And within the last year, I happened to open up this book before doing one of these weekend-long seminars. Look at the title page. The title is Alcoholics Anonymous. The subtitle is The Story of How Many Thousands of Men and Women Have Recovered from Alcoholism. So you don't have to go any further than the subtitle of the book to understand that this book's not talking about living a lifetime of illness and marrying and, you know, just trying to spin your wheels and get a little better. This book's talking like Cherry Carpenter talked to me. If you've done those first 9 steps the way the book says do them, then you are as well equipped to face life on life's terms, at least as well equipped as a person who never had alcoholism. And if you're not, you better go back and redo the steps, because you didn't do them right. And I realize now why Cherry made a point of that with me, because he knew I'd grab hold of any crutch I could. He knew that I'd be sitting in discussion meetings 5 or 10 years sober talking about, "Well, I'm an alcoholic and I can't expose myself to that sort of thing, so that's why I'm sitting here in the club playing cards 9 years sober instead of getting a job." You know, And he knew that I'd know that I was an alcoholic, and I couldn't put myself to all that stress, so I couldn't be in that condition, that I'm recovering alcoholic. You know, I'm still a sick person. Cherry wanted me to understand that that's not the way it is at all. Once I've done these 9 steps, I'm out of excuses. I'm out of excuses. Of course, I've got to live every day of my life on 10, 11, and 12, or I'll lose my recovery, and I'll fall back in the pit, and I'll die of this incurable, progressive, and fatal thing that will always sit right outside my door. It'll be there every day of my life, and on any day I don't live on 10, 11, and 12, and do that process of maintaining my spiritual condition to get my daily reprieve, I leave the gate open. And that thing could devour me on any one of those days. But I'm able to live in a state of recovery. You know, this book is going to talk to us, like I said, I'm going to talk to you about what I have done, not what I know. The book is so clear when you look at it. It says things like, it is the main purpose of this book to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. And that's in italics. And you notice that that isn't to share with other alcoholics the philosophical principles that we have absorbed in order to be transported to a sublime state of sobriety, but rather to show others precisely how we have recovered. Then it goes on a few pages later to say that if you're a real alcoholic and you're saying, I want this thing, I have to have it, what do I have to do to have it? It says it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We're going to specifically tell you what we have done that has caused recovery to take place in us. So the big book was in that tone. The big book, these folks weren't telling us what they thought they knew. They were telling us what they had done and what it had done for them. I believe the steps, which are the only program for recovery, you know, when be a member of the fellowship on any day, we've got a desire to stop drinking. But I was sponsored to believe that I can be going to 10 meetings a week, sponsoring or calling myself sponsoring 30 people, talking at conventions all over the country, and working part-time in a treatment center. And if I have not done 1 through 9 the way this book says do them, or having done that and not living on 10, 11, and 12 every day, sure, I'm a member of the fellowship because I've got a desire to stop drinking. But I'm not even a member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll have absolutely no healing of what's really wrong, except just exactly as I do these 12 steps. And, you know, they got called steps, I think, for a very good reason. They could have called them the 12 principles. They could have called them the 12 tenets. But they call them steps. And it seems clear to me why they did that. You know, if you're building a staircase, and there's some folks in here that know a little bit about carpentry, I think. But if you're building a staircase, then steps are built one on the other. Step two, the base of step two is actually on step one. Step two doesn't have a base unless it's the first step there. It doesn't make any sense to have a staircase with a second step, a sixth step, an 11th step, and not the ones in between. Just wouldn't work out. And also, I was sponsored to believe that if we weren't supposed to do these steps in order, they wouldn't have numbered them. You know, it's real simple. They assign numbers to these things. And I don't believe that we are ready for a subsequent step until we've done the one that we're working on. And I think there's a real danger to jumping ahead of ourselves. And I'll tell you real quickly, I've had any number of people say, I'm scared to do this fourth step because I can't stand going to old so-and-so and making amends. Well, my God, they're talking about step 9. They may get drunk or get run over by a truck, or the world may end before they get to step 9. You know, it has no reality at all. But see, we alcoholics, one of my favorite stories is about an alcoholic that had a flat tire out on a real dark country road at night. And first he didn't see any light at all and didn't have a jack. And he didn't see any light, so I'm in a terrible mess. And then way, way up in the distance, he saw this little pinpoint of light. So he said, well, I better start walking that way. So he starts walking toward that little pinpoint of light, and he thought, well, what if it's just an outbuilding? And then he began to be able to see there was a farm and probably a house. He said, well, you know, what if I walk up there and there's nobody at home? What if I get all the way up there and he's at home, but he's scared and he won't come answer the door? And they go, well, what if I get up here and he answers the door and he doesn't have a jack? What if I get up here and I answer the door and he's got a jack, but he won't let me use it? And they said, but what if I get up here and he's got a jack and he lets me use it, and I walk all the way back to the car and the fool thing won't fit? And about this time, he finally got to the door and he knocked on the door, and in a minute, this old farmer with his nightgown on comes and said, yes, sir, can I help you? The alcoholic says, I didn't want to borrow your damn jack anyway. So we don't want to look too far ahead, or we'll get to where we don't want to borrow the damn jack anyway. We want to take it in order. And folks, I have gone on plenty long enough tonight. We've talked about the overall process, and I think it's high time for me to quit. If anybody wants to bring up anything or say anything, we've gone as long as we want to. But from my standpoint, we'll start tomorrow with steps 1 and 2.